Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
The average American sees the word karma as shorthand for a system of cosmic justice in which everything we do comes back to us in some form of consequence. The usual adages are, what goes around comes around, or we reap what we sow. However, for those who want to understand karmic law more deeply, additional exploration is required. The concept of karma is by and large incompletely understood and frequently misapplied. As our guest today will speak about, here we'll be exploring the parallels between different spiritual traditions, spiritual insights, and doctrines regarding karma as associated with individual responsibility for our best lives, with our guest, Philip Goldberg. Philip Goldberg is an acclaimed author, public speaker, and spiritual counselor. He has studied and taught about the world's spiritual wisdom for more than 50 years. His many books include American Veda, From Emerson to the Beatles to Yoga, and Meditation, How Indian Spirituality Changed the West. Philip Goldberg teaches private online courses on the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and other topics as well. He hosts the podcast Spirit Matters with Philip Goldberg at mindbodyspirit.fm. His most recent book is Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. So please join us for the next hour as we explore the practice of karma throughout history and how it came to the West and how it applies to all aspects of self-development with our guest, Philip Goldberg. I'm speaking with Philip at his home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Philip, welcome.
Great to be with you again, Justine.
It's just great to have you once more. In my introduction, I've talked about the word karma is really ubiquitous in our society. I see karma water or karma probiotics, or the one that you mentioned that really knocked my socks off, karma medical, which produces wheelchairs. I'm just like, are you kidding? So is karma real, Philip? And if it's real, is it useful for us to even consider it?
If it wasn't, I wouldn't have written a book. Is it real? That's the first question. And I devote some time to it in Karmic Relief because we use the word. I mean, Taylor Swift believes it's real. She has a song called Karma. Artists, you know, everybody uses it. I hear it on, I'm a sports fan. I hear people talking about teams karma all the time. And so the word is useful as a kind of, as you said, a shorthand for everything having consequences. But is it real? Do we really reap what we sow? And the truth is, it can't be proven. It's presented to us by the Eastern traditions as almost like a law of physics, only there are no experiments. There's no data. And it's easy to be skeptical about karma, as I was many years ago when I first was intrigued by the concept, because you look around and you see horrible people living good and healthy and rewarding lives, and you see kind, virtuous people all the time who suffer. You know, my mother was one of those virtuous people, and she died before she was 50. And so when I read about karma, I said, don't talk me about karma. So you have to have an expansive view of the universe to believe that the universe is a fair and equitable place, because on the surface, it doesn't always seem to be, and it's very easy to be skeptical. But if you step back and look at not just our actions, but also our thoughts, our emotions, and what makes us happy and what makes us unhappy, and if you're open to the possibility of rebirth, that changes everything. Even then, it doesn't prove anything, but it makes it more rational and more plausible if you think of a sequence of lives in which karma, good and bad and neutral, can play itself out. Like going to school through a series of grades where you might not do well in the subject, but you learn as you go along. So it's hard to justify a belief in karma without that bigger perspective and those bigger assumptions. That said, there are a whole lot of people who will accept karma as a basic theory with limitations. So we all know that what we do has consequences, because we see it all the time. Right. If you're nice to someone, they're more likely to be nice to you. If you do a job with honesty and integrity, it's more likely to be rewarded. If you eat well, you're more likely to be healthy, and so forth. So on the ordinary level, we see it happening all the time. To accept it as a law of nature or the way the universe operates and be able to take into account that good actions sometimes are not rewarded and people suffer who shouldn't or don't appear to be vulnerable in that way, and the opposite, people who do bad things seem to be amply rewarded, then you have to have a bigger picture.
Right. Well, I would think that in looking at karma in that case, maybe the best option is to just look at our personal lives. Yeah. And not worry about, oh, this bad actor, he's just doing, or she's just doing terrible things. And look, they've got a big house and three islands and jet airplanes and right. So forth and so on. And it's not useful to even compare ourselves. It's like, I think what I got from Karmic Relief is to look at my own life is the most useful. And what I would love to do right now is to ask you, when the concept historically started to reveal itself, going back, I think, to 1700 BCE, called the Vedic civilization in India. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, and I want to, if I can, Justine, go back one second to believe in karma. Yes, I agree with you. Look at your own life. Things tend to have consequences. And if you are a person of conscience and you do something wrong, you will feel self-incrimination. And that alone is a consequence. There are theologians and philosophers who speak about that. Emerson is one of them, in fact. The knowledge that you did wrong is in itself a form of a consequence. We don't like when we do that, even if we don't seem to be being punished by it in any way. The other thing, where I finally come down to is this. If you live a life as if karma is real, if you take that leap and say, okay, I'm going to act as if it's real because I can't prove it, you do better in the world. You're more conscious of your actions. You're more conscious of how the effect you have on others. And that in itself has its rewards. Whereas if you assume it doesn't exist, then there's a certain lack of meaning and a certain lack of responsibility that people will give themselves reason to do.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. That's very helpful. Going back to the Vedic civilization, but I think more important, the next era was the Brahmic period, which I think was interesting. And when was, what's the difference between the two?
I'll give you the overview.
Okay.
I'm terrible with dates. And in fact, some of these dates are like, you know, this period ranges from 500 BC to 200 AD. So, you know, the people are guessing or estimating. But according to the historians I researched, the word karma, which means, by the way, action, that's literally what karma means. The word first appears in the Vedic texts, which are the oldest, what we think of as sacred texts on the planet, and this goes back, you know, thousands of years, to early Indic civilization. And in that period, what we think of as books, the books of the Vedas, which were for many centuries oral tradition before the advent of writing, they're mostly oriented around ritual. You do certain rituals, consequences occur. You chant certain mantras, these effects occur. You do these rituals, you're more likely to have good crops and so forth. And karma in those years is usually understood to have meant doing rituals in the right way to produce the right results. Over time, presumably, that evolved, either that or it was always understood but not recorded, that the term and the concept of there being consequences evolved or became expressed as everything we do, and later, everything we think, every intention we have, has consequences. And those consequences are far-reaching, and they come back to us. And that use shows up in the earliest Upanishads, which come later. The Upanishads are part of the system of thought known as Vedanta, which means the end of the Vedas or the culmination of the Vedic period. And so that's the sort of chronology or the time frame of how these things evolve. And just as other insights and revelations and ideas appear in the Upanishads for the first time, so does this use of karma. And as it's come down to us, as society's got more complex and everything, then the understanding of karma had to become more complex as well. It wasn't just a question of living in a simple culture and doing your allotted duty and being responsible for your little piece of it.
So what are some of the complexities that affect us in our own personal karma? So when you say it, everything is interdependent, I think, in so far as that we're all connected. But tell me, how does that affect us?
Well, for one thing, if you look at ethical precepts, and it comes down to that in many ways, you know, I have the practical chapters in karmic relief have to do with ethical behavior, virtuous behavior, as opposed to unethical behavior causing negative consequences. And there are systems of ethical and moral behavior in every culture. And as societies get more complex and the roles we play become less clearly defined, so too do the nuances of ethical principles. So take, for example, we shouldn't kill. That's in every tradition in the world, whether they believe in karma or not. Don't kill. Don't steal. I mean, these are things in the Ten Commandments. There are things in, you know, these are universal virtues and values. Well, at a certain point, you realize, well, we have to make exceptions for self-defense. And, you know, what if we're invaded by bad people? You know, the Bhagavad Gita, which is, you know, one of the great guideposts of living a good and spiritual life, the protagonist is a warrior. He's not a yogi living in a cave. He's a warrior, and he's got a responsibility to defend his people against what we think of as evildoers, you know, to save innocent lives and protect innocent people. To do that, he'll have to kill.
In that story with Arjuna and Krishna, there was a dilemma he had, because in wanting to kill the enemy, they were also friends of his on the other side. So say something about that's kind of the complication, isn't it?
Yes, but it's an archetype. And that's one of the reasons the Bhagavad Gita is still read by so many of us all these years later, and people in every culture, is we all face situations like that. We're not always, you know, we're not carrying around bows and arrows to defend our families and civilization, but we find ourselves in moments where doing the right thing is not necessarily clear. So in Arjuna's case, the Gita begins with him not knowing what to do. It's the eve of a battle. And you know, it's also interesting that this was a very simple time. The duties and responsibilities of people were fairly well defined. There were only a few occupational categories, and, you know, we only had a certain number of relationships, and, people were related. It was a simple society. But even in those circumstances, here's Arjuna. His primary duty as a warrior is to protect his culture, his people, his family, his, you know, the extended family, you know, the usual sort of aggregate of people in a series of villages or kingdom or whatever we call it. And every attempt to make peace with the other side in this dispute over rulership failed. And so there's about to be a battle to fight it out. And his duty would seem to be, I have to fight and protect. But, as you said, the people on the other side were like uncles and cousins and friends and all that stuff, and were duty-bound to not harm such people. So what does he do? He didn't know. He was caught between these two models or these two categories of right behavior. And so he turns to Krishna, who happens to be his charioteer, and who, you know, symbolically stands for the wisdom of the universe, the, you know, of God's will and intelligence, if we want to use that word. And he's told, well, you have to fight. That's the higher good here. That's the proper way to go, the proper action. And then, of course, 700 verses follow about living a, you know, complete life as a yogi before you go into battle. But that's the dilemma that sets off the dialogue in the book. And so there it is, even that far back. You look at the Bible. Everybody's making choices back in these, you know, or early civilizations, and some of the choices lead to disaster and some of them lead to blessings. You know, you have the book of Job where, you know, Job is wrestling with, you know, why am I being punished? I'm doing everything right. So these kinds of questions have been with human beings since the beginning. You know, as I say in the beginning of karmic relief, you know, at one point, some mother living in prehistoric, you know, cave-dwelling times probably shouted at the skies and said, why did my son get hurt in this accident and not the kid in the next cave? You know, so the universe seems to not be fair in that way on the surface. So the question then arises, is karma something people made up to make us feel better? Like, you know, people think heaven and hell, you know, were made up to make us be okay in the universe. And that's an unanswerable question. But on the level of most of our behavior and most of the way we navigate in the world, we can easily see you do good things happen to you. You do bad things happen to you.
So what I'm hearing is that it might benefit us, even when misfortunes happen, to take responsibility for course correction, so to speak.
Yes.
To notice, oh, this is happening to me. I guess for myself, as I was reading the book and I was looking at, okay, where have I made a bad decision and how did it affect me for quite a while? And now what am I doing with that? And this had to do with my negating my responsibility or my intelligence in participating with the full economic situation of my husband and myself.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of left it all up to him. I just sort of bowed out. And that had devastating consequences. Mm. He did not have access to my wisdom. And so now, at this point, I am in course correction. And, of course, Michael has passed on, so I can't handle it with him. But I can handle it in my life and in my work.
Yeah. You are a symbol of our whole civilization not having men have the advantage of women's wisdom.
Yeah, for sure. That's coming up more and more and more, that the consequences of a patriarchy, so to speak, that has been heading up this particular civilization. And it may be shifting. May it be so?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I understand. One of the misunderstandings that I find people in sort of casual use of the word karma, I have a whole section on different misunderstandings. One of them is that it excuses people. No, every wise person who's discoursed about karma makes the most important point, which is karma places full responsibility on us. It's not a cop-out. And people use it that way. You know, well, it's karma. Everything's going to unfold the way it was meant to be. No. You have a role to play. You are creating your karma at every moment. And everything that happens that affects you is the result of past karma. So if you accept karma as real, or even as likely to be real, it puts on your shoulders full responsibility for whatever happens to you. And that I find one of the most important reasons for people to, if you're going to take a leap of faith in either direction, if you move toward, okay, I'll accept karma as real, you'll behave more responsibly.
Yes, I would think so. I'm thinking about how, let's say, misfortunes happen, and there are two really very powerful examples that you give, and one is from the Dalai Lama when he was asked about who is his greatest teacher. And so that was one. And the other was Ram Dass when he had a stroke. And both of those are terrible things. And I want to talk about both of those in just one moment. But I want to also remind us that we're here talking about karma, about whether it's real or whether it's not, and it may not even matter if it's real or not. That's not what we're really looking forward to, but how it affects our lives right now. What is our responsibility towards karma and how we're doing it? And you've really outlined this very well in your book, Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. So this is really very exciting stuff. So as we said at the very beginning of this interview, that the word karma is just ubiquitous. So, and it is highly misunderstood in so many ways. So we're going to get into talking about some of the practices that we can do that are long established practices throughout time and from many religions, especially Hinduism and Buddhism, which we'll be talking about in just one moment. I'm here with Philip Goldberg, and he is the author of Karmic Relief. And if you want to know more about being in touch with him, you can go to his website, philipgoldberg.com. And he spells his first name, Philip, with one L, philipgoldberg.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Philip Goldberg, and he is the author of Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life, and has a podcast, Spirit Matters with Philip Goldberg, at mindbodyspirit.fm, or you can go to his website, philipgoldberg.com, spelling his name Philip with a one L, philipgoldberg.com. So I just mentioned about the lessons that the Dalai Lama gave when he was asked about his teacher, a great teacher for him. And he said, Mao Zedong. So say something about why he said that.
Well, everybody knows that the Dalai Lama, as a young man, was forced into exile from Tibet by the communists.